It's the 30th of October 1914, and it's the First Battle of Ypres. Enormous German army is moving towards that city of Ypres. It's the Bavarian Reserve Division that's in the front line, and they're bringing up their heavy artillery. The regular, professional, old, contemptible British army are trying to defend the low ridges that 3 years later they would be attacking up. Not the same men, because so many of the men that we're going to discuss this week were no longer fighting after this day. A German army order of the day said this: "The breakthrough will be of decisive importance. We must and will conquer, settle forever the centuries-long struggle, end the war and strike the decisive blow against our most detested enemy. We will finish the British, the Indians, the Canadians, Moroccans and other trash, feeble adversaries who surrender in great numbers if they are attacked with vigour." Well, many of them did surrender that day. They had no choice. But it didn't end the war. It wasn't a decisive blow. There was much bloodshed on that day and in the months and the years that followed in this area around the small village of Zandvoort. That village of Zandvoort sits on a slight rise, and the church on top of it dominates the area around it. In a few days before the 30th of October, the date that we're going to discuss today, it was the Household Cavalry that was defending the line here. And it was where Lord Charles Worsley, who was 27 years old, was killed in action. An order to withdraw did not reach his machine gun section that he was in charge of. And they were cut off and he was listed as missing and was officially recorded as dead in 1915. But what they didn't know was his body had been found and buried by the Germans. In 1921, his body was exhumed and concentrated into the Ypres Town Military Cemetery extension. If you go to that spot now, there's a memorial to the Household Cavalry, and that's built on the spot where Worsley's original grave was located. And his name is on the bottom of the memorial. At this early stage of the war, Sir Douglas Haig, who was to go on to be, as we know, the Commander-in-Chief of the British Expeditionary Force, was a corps commander. And it was him that was trying to organise the defence around the Ypres salient. When he received news that this unit had been pushed back, perhaps Haig spared a personal thought for Lord Worsley, because Worsley was married to his wife's younger sister. So Haig was related to him through marriage. But at 9 o'clock on the 30th of October, the Germans had captured the trenches that were held by the cavalry, and they were working their way along that ridge past Zandvoort village, and their plan was to attack the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and they were on their flank. And by 10 o'clock, the entire ridge was in German hands. They sent up every available reserve to try and take it back and back them up with every available gun, did those Welsh Fusiliers. But far more guns were ranged against them. Battling through fearsome shellfire, their progress was painful and slow. They were far too few and far too late to succeed in capturing Zandvoort. And the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, that battalion of men from the valleys, was absolutely annihilated. There was only 86 survivors, which 3 weeks earlier had consisted of 1,100 men. But their counterattack, that brave counterattack, at least ensured that the Germans got no further. How do I know this? Well, I've turned to Lynn MacDonald, a famous author who died a couple of years ago. She wrote a book famously about the Somme, but this one she called simply 1914. And that's where I got that summary from. So welcome to this week's podcast with me, Terry Wenham, Towers in the Battlefields. Coming up to the fourth anniversary of the podcast now. And this week, I'm going to talk to a man from New Zealand, Nick Duna, because one of his ancestors was a captain in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers that morning. We're going to talk about him and his role in the battle and how Nick found him by chance on a battlefield trip to Ypres in 2018 and how it led him to find Captain Duna's brother who died at the other end of the war nearly 4 years later. This is Tales from the Battlefields. We said in the beginning when I started this podcast that I wanted to feature the stories of men whose stories perhaps hadn't been told before and not in the history books. The stories of these two officers falls into that category. One of the reasons why I enjoy continuing with this podcast, one of the many reasons actually, is because I'm learning all the time. I'm discovering more stories, and as I do, I understand the Great War in more detail. My understanding increases, and it helps me appreciate the sacrifice that those young men gave so that we could live the lives that we do today. I know it's a simple message, but I think it's a message that we can't say often enough. The names of those small villages just to the east of Ypres, which become very well known to the men of the Commonwealth forces and the German forces over the next 4 years, like Zandvoort that we're going to talk about today, and Hoog and Gullevelt, Zillebeek, Zonnebeek, Passchendaele village itself. But in 1914, in October 1914, they perhaps wouldn't have heard of them. They certainly wouldn't be familiar with them. It was the start of the stalemate that was to last, as I say, for well over 3 years. The start of the war on the Western Front in 1914 was still one of movement and manoeuvre, perhaps a reflection on previous conflicts in Northern Europe. These vast armies were clashing on battlefields across not just Belgium, but France as well, vying for territory and trying, as armies have always have done, to find opportunities to outflank one another and get behind. The Allies of France and the British Empire and Belgium had been forced into retreat with heavy cost to both sides. Hundreds of thousands of men had already been wounded and thousands more killed. And after the Battle of the Marne, it was Germany's time to retreat, as both armies again tried to outflank each other in this series of manoeuvres that was to become known as the Race to the Sea. And that went on to several weeks and was thought to have finished around about the 17th of October. And the first elements of the British Expeditionary Force arrived at Ypres on the 8th of October. And by the 19th of October, the British had arrived in force and they occupied a 35-mile long line in the centre of the Allied lines. Indian Army troops were also part of the British Imperial Forces at this stage. And they would fight with distinction alongside their British counterparts, particularly in that first battle on the Messines Ridge. Trench networks were beginning to be dug and fortifications built, and the Ypres salient was beginning to take shape. Not the deep trenches that we were to become, and they were to become familiar with in the years to become, but perhaps just foxholes or shallow scrapes in the ground, anything to give them cover from artillery fire and bullets that would be flying across the open ground of the Belgian countryside. The Allies chose to dig in such a way because their lines could be easily defended from a low ridge of higher ground to the east of Ypres. But it made it vulnerable to attack from a much more superior German artillery. The Germans began the major offensive on the 20th of October. The goal of the German army was to split open the Allied positions around Ypres to capture the Channel ports of Dunkirk, Calais and Boulogne, just as they were to do 26 years later. Capturing Ypres would be the key to controlling these Channel ports. The Germans attacked the Belgium army to start with. They were holding a line across the Saar River between Dixmude and Nieuport up on the coast. The Belgium army had already been weakened by weeks and months of fighting. They fought valiantly, did those Belgians, on their home ground. But they had to rely on nature to stem the German assault. The Belgian King Albert, who was commander-in-chief of his nation's armed forces, ordered the opening of the sluice gates that kept seawater at bay in the low ground of northern Belgium. Water rushed over the land, and there was a 2-mile-wide barrier was placed in front of the Germans, and Falkenhayn, the German commander, the chief of the German general staff, he had to rethink his plans. The Belgians had suffered 18,000 casualties, but they'd secured the Allied flank in the north. And now it was the British turn to withstand a German assault. On the 28th of October, British counterattacks against the Germans had started to break down. The Germans reorganised their forces and they began to probe the British line a bit further south. On the 29th, the Germans attacked the Gullivelt crossroads on the Menin Road. And by nightfall, the crossroads had been captured, as had 600 British soldiers. By now, the Germans were within a couple of miles of Ypres itself. And the British troops were pushed out of villages like Zandvoort, Hollebeek, but even further south at Messines and Weichater, the German attacks were repulsed. The British did, as we're going to find out, rally at Zandvoort, but they suffered enormous casualties, as had the Indian Army troops that had been brought into the battle. On the 31st of October, the German army managed to break through, but then there was that famous counterattack spearheaded by the 2nd Worcestershires that restored the situation. An attack that's gone down in folklore, and perhaps we'll talk about that in a future podcast. While all this is going on in the face of overwhelming opponents, the British and their allies continue to display a high degree of marksmanship, rate of fire and discipline of its highly trained and professional soldiers. And that's where our story today ends. Because, as I said, we're going to be talking about the Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And their story ends that day. We look, as we always do, at the battalion diary to try and find out some information. And this is what it says. No accurate information is obtainable regarding this action, but it is hoped that the record will be verified and completed with further details on return to duty of those officers who were actually engaged and now prisoners of war. No officer remained after the 30th of October, and the party which survived the action on that day, approximately 86 other ranks, were attached to the 2nd Queen's. So the battalion diary was usually written up by officers who could tell us through their own eyes what had happened that day. But they couldn't write the battalion diary up because there were no officers left. And most of them were to remain in German captivity until the end of the war. They were commanded that day by Lieutenant Colonel Henry Osbert Samuel Cadogan. He was to fall that day and is buried next to Alfred Edwin Claude Toke Duna, who is the main feature in today's podcast. He was commanding the 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Cadogan was 46 years old, Duna much younger, at just 22. So who was the 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers? Well, like so many of these professional units, they'd been abroad when war broke out in August of 1914, and they were actually in Malta. They returned to England, landed in Southampton on the 3rd of September 1914, and they joined the 22nd Brigade of the 7th Division, who were concentrating in the New Forest in Hampshire. The whole division landed at Zeebrugge on the 7th of October 1914. They tried to assist in the Belgian defence of the city of Antwerp, but they were too late to prevent the fall of the city, and they then took up defensive positions at important bridges and junctions to aid the retreat of the Belgian army. The 7th Division, including the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, became one of the first British units to arrive on that high ground to the east of Ypres. And that's where their story, as far as we're concerned today, begins. And as we've already discovered, the only way we can find out exactly what happened is by listening to the accounts of the men that were either wounded or taken prisoner and finally returned home. What the Germans did was occupy a large farmhouse, which was just about 30 yards to the right of the trenches where the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were trying to shelter in those very shallow trenches. But the Germans were able to fire at them at such a short range. I mean, 30 yards with a machine gun or a machine gun is effectively point-blank range. And that's exactly what they did. More Germans began to work their way around to the rear and the left of the Welsh, using the hedgerows that were still there at that time. And soon the Germans were attacking from all sides, and the Welshmen were completely surrounded. Section by section, the Royal Welshmen fought it out. And Captain Duna, whose relative we're going to speak to later, was the adjutant. He'd been sent from battalion headquarters with orders, and as he was returning, the commanding officer, Cadogan, saw him fall. And we'll find out a bit later what Henry Cadogan did when he saw Duna fall. But we can now look at those personal accounts. This one was written by a Lieutenant Woodhouse, who was wounded and then taken prisoner. He said, "We were holding a line about 3/4 of a mile long. A company on the right, then B, D and C on the left. The trenches were not well sighted for field of fire. So far as I know, no one was on our right. Some Blues were supposed to be there, but I did not see them. It was foggy in the early morning, so the Germans could not shell us much, which was lucky, as they had two batteries on the Zandvoort Ridge. About 8 a.m. the shelling increased, and we saw large numbers of Germans advancing down a slope about 1,500 yards to our front. Also, I believe, large numbers were seen coming around our exposed right flank. The batteries on the ridge were now firing point-blank into our trenches, so that it was difficult to see what was happening, and the rifle fire also increased from our right rear. No orders were received, so it was thought best to stay where we were, and about midday, the whole battalion was either killed, wounded, or taken prisoner." Casualties were Colonel Cadogan, Duna, Egerton, and an officer from the Cornwalls killed. Some of the men from our battalion did make it out of the battle and mustered the following day at Hoog. There was just the quartermaster and 85 men. 7 officers and 320 other ranks were either killed, wounded or missing. I have here a German account of what it was like to fight around Gullevelt and Zandvoort on the Ypres salient in that first battle at the end of October 1914. And this German soldier is called Paul Hubb, and he wrote to his wife Maria. This is what he said. "My dear Maria, I feel so terrible, I'd rather not write to you. That doesn't mean I've forgotten you, though. Every day spent here makes it clearer to me how beautiful home is, and what a crowd of feelings that word home brings out to me. I have lived through such horror recently, no words can describe it, the tragedy all around me. Every day the fighting gets fiercer, and there is still no end in sight. Our blood is flowing in torrents. When I think of our 247th Regiment, my eyes swim with tears. The 1st and 2nd Battalions only have 250 to 300 men left, so more than half are gone. Today only a few of my comrades will still be standing. My company commander, Lieutenant Masbauer, had been at the front for 1 hour when he was shot through the head. Pale and close to death, he was carried past me. Today, Sunday, I stood at his modest grave and joined in a prayer. That's how it is. All around me, the most gruesome devastation. Dead and wounded soldiers, dead and dying animals. Horses, burnt out houses, dug up fields, cars, clothes, weaponry. All this is scattered around me, a real mess. I didn't think war would be like this. We can't sleep for all the noise. At least 30 shells explode at once the whole time. We called for backup yesterday and today. I hope they make it. There are only a few of us left to tackle the English. I managed to wash myself properly yesterday for a change. My beard is getting ever longer. Otherwise, I'm feeling fine. All this noise is not going to ruffle my Württemberg calm. The English soldier can now move much more freely than we can. With their practical clothing and their light packs, they can run like hares. This really is an advantage when under fire, but we're still going to win. I give you, my most beloved, a big loving hug. I'm so lucky to have you, my love. Yours, Paul. As I'm reading that, it occurs to me that on the other side of that terrible battlefield was English soldiers and Welsh soldiers and soldiers from other Commonwealth countries writing letters back to their own Marias, their own sweethearts, their own parents and friends, and their sentiments will be exactly the same. The shared experience of the soldiers of the Great War. A human being by nature will do anything he can to avoid being killed or dying. Of course, a soldier, no matter how experienced or how inexperienced, whether it be professional or a volunteer or a territorial, no matter who he is, they'll go to extraordinary lengths to live just one more day. And looking at the South Wales newspapers of November 1914, I found a number of accounts from Welshmen that were there. If you remember, the battalion diary couldn't tell us what had happened because there was no officers left. But we do have some accounts from private soldiers, and this one is a Private Hugh Williams. The article says, a soldier who feigned death, he used a pillow by a wounded German. A Fusilier's amazing adventures, the headline says. Prior to the war, Private Williams worked in the sawmills at Port Sunlight and lived in Rock Ferry. He was in the disaster when the Germans surrounded them in overwhelming numbers and only escaped through lying down in a trench after being wounded and feigning death. During the night, he'd been unable to sleep owing to the cold and having no overcoat. At 6 o'clock in the morning, they were served with rations. I opened a tin of bully beef, said Williams. And we said, we'll have a bit of breakfast before they come. I knew the Germans were coming. We could hear their Maxims, machine guns, he means. I just had a mouthful when I saw them approaching in our rear and on the right flank. Many of them were directly behind us, and we opened fire. I'm certain that I knocked 12 down. As soon as I pulled the trigger, I saw my man fall. They were so close, only 100 yards away. But they came on, right up to our fellows, who were firing point blank into their faces. The last I heard was Lieutenant Egerton ordering us to fix bayonets. The Germans were then 20 yards off, when I was wounded above the left eye with a ricocheting bullet, which glanced off. I could see our colonel, who was about 100 yards away, in tears, and then I saw two other lieutenants being made prisoners. After this, my mate, Private Morgan, was shot right through the head by a German officer, his brains scattered over the trench. I said to myself, I'm the next one, as I lay down in the trench. I thought, I may as well as lie here as if I were dead. The Germans jumped into the trench to take cover, and from there they kept firing. One of them picked up a wounded German and put him across my body, resting his head on my pack while he dressed his wounds. I was covered with blood. After that, I lay in the trench for 5 hours. The overcoat, cap and pack belonging to the wounded German, who had been taken away, were left behind. So I put the coat and cap on and I walked to a Belgian house about 150 yards away. I stopped there for 5 days, living on peas that grew close by. The big guns kept on firing the whole time. After a visit to the deserted trenches to see if he could recognise any of the dead, Private William, still wearing his German coat and hat, decided to leave the neighbourhood. Taking his bearings from the position of the sun, knowing that in this direction lay the sea, he began to walk westwards, and after going for about 6 miles, he came to a house and stopped at the pump outside for a drink. A Belgian came out of the house and, saying, "Coffee," beckoned him inside. "He seemed frightened," continued Williams, "and he must have taken me for a German with my grey coat and hat. So I said English and opened my coat and showed him my khaki clothes and putties. He was then most pressing and took me inside, where I saw his wife and 6 daughters. They gave me some coffee and a pipe and tobacco, and that night I slept there. The next day a guide took me away. I was not to open my mouth to anyone. I was supposed to be deaf and dumb. We passed hundreds of Germans on the road, and none of them spoke to us. On the following morning, another man took me in hand, and we went along the canal, where I got a train. Eventually, Williams got to Folkestone and then reported himself to Thorncliffe, and he was sent to Wrexham Barracks and placed on leave. It's like hell out there," was one of his last remarks. Another man who spoke to the newspapers back home was Private Harry Wilkes. He'd managed to get home to West Bromwich in the West Midlands, and he was recovering from a shrapnel wound in his leg, what a British soldier called a blighty. He went out with the rest of the regiment in early October. He said, "I think we were going to Antwerp, but on the way we met the naval brigade retreating, and they told us that Antwerp had fallen. We entrenched ourselves outside Ghent and covered the retirement of the Belgian army. Then we retired through Ghent to Thielt and Roulers, and eventually took up a position outside Ypres. They subjected us to very heavy shell fire and rifle fire. Their infantry tried to force us back, and we continually repulsed them with heavy loss. We were fighting night and day, blown from trench to trench by tremendous artillery fire, and we suffered very heavily. The brigade tried to capture some of the German guns at Menin, and we drove the enemy out of a village, but they were too strong for us and forced us back. They mowed us down with their firing. Finally, we reached Zonnebeek, and the order came that we had to hold our position there at all costs until reinforcements came. The fighting was continuous, but our men never lost heart, and although we suffered heavy casualties, we stuck it. The strength of the German lies in the tremendous number of troops they have at their disposal. They came up in such masses that our fire told on them with terrible effect, and their losses were tremendous. The ground in front of our trenches was simply covered with bodies. During the day, the Germans shelled our trenches, and most of their infantry attacks were made at night. Then we sent out a listening post of 2 men, who, when they heard the enemy advancing, brought the news to us. We got ready to receive them, and when the word to fire was given, we had what we called the mad minute. Every man fired as fast as he could, and we gave them 15 to 20 rounds a minute, while the machine guns kept up a constant stream of shots. It was one continuous roar of firing. Though the Germans were so superior in number, we held them at bay, and eventually the French troops arrived and took over our trenches. We were moved further along to the right, and we thought we were going to have a rest, when the news came that the Bavarians were advancing and we had to meet them. We charged them with the bayonet and repulsed them, and it was in this affair that I received my wound. A shell dropped into the middle of us, killing 12 men outright and wounding another 20. I got a shrapnel bullet through my left leg and lay there for 4 hours. Then I was removed to the hospital at Poppering and subsequently sent back to England. I had a month in the battle at Ypres, and a terrible time it was too. Private Wicks went on to describe the discipline and conduct of the British troops as being splendid, and he holds a very high opinion of the quality of Belgian troops too. He says they were gallant fighters. So their commanding officer was Henry Osbert Samuel Cadogan, who'd been born in 1868, and along with Duna was reported missing on that day. And it was a while before it was confirmed that both men had been killed. And it was Cadogan himself that rushed to the help of Duna when he saw him fall. Cadogan was the only surviving son of the Reverend Edward Cadogan, and he joined the Royal Welsh Fusiliers in 1888 and was promoted to captain in 1896 and major in 1907, and he took over the command of the 1st Battalion as early as 1912, and he'd served in the Far East and in the relief of Peking in China in 1900, had been mentioned in dispatches by Sir John French, who at that stage was the commander-in-chief of the BEF. He left an only son who'd been born in 1908. And as for Duna, his full name, as I mentioned earlier, Alfred Edwin Claude Duna, he came from Maidstone in Kent, the same town that my own family come from, my great uncle and grandfather. He'd served in the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers and had been born at Portsmouth, in 1892. He went to the King's School in Rochester, and indeed there is a memorial to both brothers in Rochester Cathedral. He became a cadet officer in the Officer Training Corps in 1909. He was very good at shooting, won lots of awards at school, and also excelled at rugby. He went up to Sandhurst in 1910, and he was gazetted as a second lieutenant in the Welsh Fusiliers in 1911, promoted to lieutenant in the following year. And it was in July of 1914 that he became the adjutant of the 1st Battalion. And whilst he was at university, he excelled in German and became a first-class interpreter, having previously in 1908, when he was at Tonbridge, gained first prize in that language in the examination that was open to all members of all public schools. This was a very talented young man. As we know, he went to Belgium with his battalion in early October and was reported missing after this battle on the 30th of October 1914. And the article that I'm reading says, from reports received from officers and men who were present on this occasion, it would appear that the struggle for Zandvoort was most severe, as the Germans were endeavouring to get through to Calais and the line occupied by the division was extended and thinly held. On the right of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, there were some trenches occupied by dismounted cavalry fighting as infantry, and how well these trenches were held is described by an officer who says it was one of the finest feats of the war. So well did the cavalry fight that nearly all were killed or wounded, and the trenches were eventually captured, leaving the right flank of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers open to a flank attack. Lieutenant Duna, seeing the danger, ran across a fire-swept piece of ground to the company on the right, and having carried out his instructions, was returning to join his commanding officer, where he was seen to fall wounded. Lieutenant Colonel Cadogan then ran to his assistance, accompanied, as he stated, by Sergeant H. Evans. They found that Duna had been killed, and as they were returning, Sergeant Evans states that Cadogan was also shot down about 10 yards from their trenches. Lieutenant Duna, at the time of his death, was the youngest adjutant in the regular British Army. The village of Zandvoort then stayed behind German lines until the Third Battle of Passchendaele, nearly 3 years later. So the Germans buried both officers, Cadogan and Duna, and also a private soldier from the same battalion, a Private Davis. And it wasn't until 1919 that their bodies were found, and they were exhumed and reinterred in the large concentration cemetery on the Menin Road, a couple of miles away, now known as the Hoog Crater Cemetery. The Germans erected a wooden cross on top of Cadogan's grave, no doubt the other two as well. That wooden cross, would you believe, still exists. And even more remarkable, as far as I'm concerned, it's about 10 miles away from where I'm sitting now. It's displayed on a larger memorial at St. Peter's Church in the village of Gayhurst, which is near Newport Pagnell in Buckinghamshire. And on the memorial, it says, in loving memory of Lieutenant Colonels Cadogan, and it says, in the 7th Division, he was killed during the First Battle of Ypres at Zandvoort on the morning of October the 30th, 1914, while trying to save his adjutant, Captain Duna, and was buried in Hooge Cemetery on the 21st of May, 1919. This wooden cross marks the spot where his body was found by his brother-in-law, Walter, who, with his wife, Blanche, erected this tablet. On him be peace and the blessing, for he was great-hearted. And as I said, part of that original German cross is fixed to that plaque, and there are some German words written on it which translated say, "Here rests an Englishman." Now, we heard from the various accounts the very serious, heavy casualties that the Royal Welsh Fusiliers suffered on the 30th of October. And by looking at the website of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, we can see that 88 of them were eventually discovered as having been killed in action on that day. And of those, as you might expect, 82 of them have no known grave and are remembered on the Menin Gate. And in the Hooge Crater Cemetery lies Private Davis alongside his two officers, Cadogan and Duna. They're buried together. They were found together, and they'll remain together forevermore. The clock now goes forward to 2018, and a man from Auckland in New Zealand has made his way over to Europe for a battlefield tour, and he's hired a guide from Ypres called Patrick, and Patrick takes him to the Hooge Crater Cemetery, where he points out to him the grave of Lieutenant Duna, who's a relative he didn't even know he had. Like so many of us in this situation, it was a life-changing moment for Nick. As he explained to me when I spoke to him from his home in Auckland the other day. So welcome to the podcast, Nick, Tales from the Battlefields. Tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all, because you're not in Europe, are you? You're a long way away from here.
No, I am in New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand. I am a retired TV cameraman. I had 47 years with a company called Television New Zealand, and really enjoyed my career. I've just learned so much about, my colleagues taught me a lot about asking the questions, investigating, and it's just been so handy for this journey that I've been on.
Yeah, it's the same process, isn't it? You become a detective.
It's the same process as give me a name, give me a date, give me a place, and I'll come up with something.
Yeah.
And you know, knocking on doors and all of those kinds of things. So certainly through this journey, I've never given up. I've just kept coming to the UK, to Ireland, to wherever. I've kept looking ever since this first discovery in Ypres.
Yep. And what did you know about your but obviously we're going to feature both of your relatives that are buried on the Western Front. Did you know about them then before you came to Europe on the battlefield tour?
As I got into like more my teens and my 20s and stuff like that, we all kind of asked the question, you know, where do we come from, and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And my father, he was British Royal Navy. He came to New Zealand on a aircraft carrier called HMS Glory. In the 80s, I started to ask those questions like most kids, like, who am I? Where do I come from? And my mother, having told me quite a lot about my New Zealand history and what happened with her father in the First World War and those sorts of things, and talking about the stories of the trenches and the rats as big as dogs and the mud and all of that kind of stuff that they went through, I wanted to know from my father about our British heritage, and I had tried a number of times during the 80s, and it was just stonewalled. He wouldn't talk about anything about it.
Oh, right.
And I'd say, Dad, you know, who are we?
Yeah.
What's our British heritage? Where do we come from?
Yeah.
Who am I? Those kinds of things. And I would just get these kind of blank looks, and he wouldn't say anything about it. And he passed away in 2009, and I thought, that's it. I am never going to know who I am on my father's side.
Yeah.
So I didn't know much about my family in the UK, living family. And I did know that I had some cousins in London, and fortunately a few years beforehand they had come to New Zealand. So Carol and I reciprocated by coming to their place.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons why we were coming. And I said to my wife, Carol, I said, well, in terms of my grandfather on my mother's side from the New Zealand Expeditionary Force, we should go to Belgium. We should go to find out where the Kiwis were. And I just happened to be talking to a friend of mine who said, you've got to go. You've got to go to Ypres. You've got to go to the Menin Gate. You've got to go on a tour." And gave me some ideas about that, and we thought this is fantastic. So we flew off to London, and the first thing that happened was that I met at my cousin's place in London. Her name's Marion, and her husband's name is Norman. And we arrived in the UK. We're sitting down to lunch, and Norman gets his laptop out and he opens it, and it has a picture of a guy. And he said, "Do you know you're related to these people, this person?" And I was completely blank. I had no idea what he was talking about. It completely skipped over my head. And then he said, "This is Captain Boomer of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers." And I was like, "Yeah." I didn't mean anything at that stage because I didn't know anything about these people.
It's out of the
And then
blue.
he skipped through the photos, and then he said, "Do you know you're also related to this guy, Lieutenant Colonel John Graham Dooner of the Royal Artillery?" I was like, "No, I don't know." And I look at that moment now and I say, that could have been a completely lost opportunity right then and there, because I didn't understand who these people were or what they meant to me. The plan was, which what we did, was that Carol and I would go to France. We were going on a World War II tour.
You were going to
So
Normandy,
we
weren't you?
were, yes, so we were heading for the Normandy beaches. So we were on a tour there for quite a few days around Normandy and Omaha and all those kinds of things. Just going back slightly, just before we left London, I mentioned to Norman, we're going to Ypres, we're going on this tour. And he said, "I'd love to come. I'll meet you there." And I thought, yeah, great. So we do our World War II stuff and Normandy and all that and Paris and whatnot. And then we get the train to up to Ypres, and we go into the little town there, and Norman arrives, and we've got our B&B, and we all stay together. Fantastic little town and place and all that kind of stuff. We meet up with the tour guide. I wanted to go to all the well-known and famous places that the Kiwis had been, and the Messines Ridge. And
Of course.
my wife Carol's in the front with Patrick, and Norman and I are in the back. And I noticed that Norman had a file with him, and he leaned forward to Patrick and he said, "Patrick, do you know anything about a Captain Dooner?" Patrick had the iPad set up on the front in the car, and he whisked through and he said, "Yeah, I've got a listing for this guy, and we're going to go be going past there this afternoon, so we will call in." Well, okay, yep. So sure enough, we arrived at, is it Hoog? Is that the
Yeah,
correct way
Hoog
to say it?
Crater, yeah, on the Menin Road, yeah.
Yep, Hoog Crater Cemetery, and it drops down as like a valley
That's right.
of headstones, and we go down through the middle, and we turned left at the bottom there. We headed along the rows, and Patrick said, "There you go, there's your relative."
And
And
what
I
relative
was
was he to you? Obviously, on your father's side, was he a great uncle? Was he a brother of your grandfather or something?
Hang on, just my great grandfather's brother, his name was William. Captain Dooner is his son.
But there you are, suddenly, at Hoog Crater on the other side of the world from where you come from. And you're looking down at a headstone with the name of a young man on there, which is your own family name. Had you got the photograph with you at that stage then of him?
No, I had nothing.
Yeah, nothing at that stage.
This was completely unplanned and unexpected. I did not know of this soldier, and I thought, "Who is this? What is this about?" I thought. I was speechless, overcome, and unable to advance any empathy or any idea about what this
Oh,
was about.
really? Right.
I knew absolutely nothing. It was just Norman mentioned the name, Patrick did the link, we were there. I'm standing in front of a headstone with my family name on it. And I was just awestruck. I was, what does this mean? What is this about? Who is this person? What does this mean to me?
And in a way, this was part of the answer to the questions that you'd been asking your father for all those years.
It's that one incident that started all of this. And none of these facts came from my father.
No. Yeah. And maybe he didn't know himself about the story of the Doona brothers. He might not have known himself about it.
He'd be very surprised if I was able to tell him now.
I know, that's right. Yeah. All these, again, it's something about family history and military history that you always have that thought, don't you? If only I could speak to them, whether it's your own dad or the people that are beneath the headstone. Wouldn't it be great to have to be able to sit in a pub, in Ypres by the Menin Gate and have a chat with these lads and your dad? Wouldn't it be great to do that?
Fascinating. I have so many questions, so
Mm.
many. Just while I'm standing there completely dumbfounded as
Yeah.
to what this guy means, and and there's the colonel beside him, so we're all on that. Why are they in this line together?
Yeah.
Why are they all from the same regiment? What happened to these guys on the 30th of October 1914? And we had to go back there the next day because just my mind was racing that night, that day.
I bet you didn't
What
sleep that
was,
night, did you? Bet you
I
didn't
didn't
sleep
sleep that
well.
night. Doona is not a common name.
No, that's right. No.
And to see one in a, on a headstone in a grave in Belgium, like what? What is this? Who is this? What does this mean? So we went back the next day, as I say, and we sat there in front of this grave for about an hour. And we were just trying to fathom what it meant. And obviously we had no idea. A chap that came cycling down next in the paddock next door and climbed the
Yep.
fence and came over to see us. And we were kind of like, gosh, are we supposed to be here? Is there a problem, or what's all this about? And he just leaned forward and said, "Your relative." And I said, "Yes, I believe so." And he just shook my hand and said, "Thank you for your sacrifice," and left. Something happened here, and we're going to need to know more. We went back to London, and I'm sitting there in the bedroom in the morning, and Norman comes in and says to me, it was my cousin Norman, "I think I found the brother. His name is Lieutenant Colonel John Graham Doona. And I think I've found him in France." And he said, "We've got to go there." And I said, "Okay, let's go." So we took the channel, we drove, Norman took us, and we were heading for Soissons in northern eastern France. There was just barley fields everywhere, and in the distance we could see a large cross. And Norman said, looking at the maps, "That's got to be it." And we arrived there, and once again, a beautiful Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery, just in the middle of nowhere. I don't know, a good 40, 45 minutes going around all the rows, and then someone just called out, "Here he is." And once again, I walked up to another grave with my family name on it. And I was dumbstruck. I was like, what is this again?
But we're at two ends of the war, aren't we?
Yes.
We've got one at Ypres in 1914, and the other brother, in 1918 in the final offensive.
We took photos and spent some time there just in the quiet, just thinking about it, looking at it, that sort of thing. And it was a beautiful sunny day. And then I signed a condolences book, and Norman said, came up to me and he said, "What did you write?" And I said, "Though I never met you, now I know you."
That's fantastic. Yeah.
And so began another journey
Yeah.
of trying to find out who these people were.
Yeah.
So that was those two bits of information
That
that
took you on
has
a journey.
took me on a something like an 8-year journey, hundreds of documents,
Yeah.
photos. And then I came home and I thought, I have to start this journey. I have to start the search. I have to, and I use the professional skills that I have to go there. But that gave me the time to start the journey of doing the digging, of writing to just everything that I could think of. As I say, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, the Royal Artillery, museums, the three brothers, two die in the First World War in 1914, 1918.
And
There's
did
one
neither of
survivor.
those had a child then? The two that died, they didn't have a child.
No,
No, right.
no,
Yeah, okay, so it's
no.
William. William is the key, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes. So Alfred was only 22 when he died.
Yeah.
John was 39
Yeah.
in the Royal Artillery. And he was married but had no children.
Yeah.
And then there was another son called William Dundas Dooner.
Yes,
And
yeah.
he's the surviving son
Who's gone
in
on to
all
have a
of this.
family. Yeah.
And he had children
Yeah.
that went down the chain to my cousin
Yeah.
Martin,
Yeah.
who now lives in Yorkshire. And I thought, well, I've got to find this guy. So usual kind of digging and Facebook and all that kind of stuff, and came up with a name. And I waited a week or two, whatnot, still hadn't heard anything. It was getting a bit closer to when we were to depart New Zealand. And I was working a night shift, and I came home, and bingo, there was an email there and said, yes, I'm Martin Dooner. And he said, oh, I didn't know we had relatives in New Zealand on the other side of the world, da 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 da. And so it started off. And he sent me some information, but he said, I have photos and I have scrapbooks and I have diaries that you will be interested in. But just opened up. He had photos of my family from the 1860s.
Right.
And to pick that up and look at your great grandfather, and you've been
Yeah.
searching for 5 or 6 years, and there's
Yeah,
that
it's
person
brilliant.
right in front of you, was just wow.
And in amongst all his documentation, was there any personal diaries that Alfred or John had left behind?
No, I when we went to Enniskillen to see the curator there, the team there were just fantastic.
Yeah.
And we sat, we talked, and then the chairman of the museum said, let's go down to the library, their own private research library, not a public area. We went through several doors, swipe doors, to get into there, and they said, Colonel William Toke Dooner has a file somewhere in this museum.
Yeah.
And we went into this little room, and it was just full of these grey boxes.
Yeah.
And he said, he'll be in here somewhere.
Yeah.
And he's number so and so and so and so. And after about 40 minutes of looking, we were, dunno. And I just happened to look up, and there was a box that was sticking out from the others, and it's got his name on it.
Yeah.
And it's right above my head.
Right, it's meant to
And
be.
the luck of it. And we pull it out, and there's documents and there's family photos and all that kind of stuff. So
Wow.
took that back to the library, and I digitalized all of that. The scrapbook that Captain Dooner and Lieutenant Colonel John Graham Dooner, their father kept this scrapbook, and the information in there has just been quite staggering.
Yeah.
The of their son, Alfred, and the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, their search for the son, the newspaper ads they ran, the letters they had from people saying, oh no, he's alive, he was captured, he's a prisoner, and all of those kinds of things.
Really?
I think it roughly went on for about a year before they actually really knew what had happened to him.
Because although they were buried, the three men that died together were buried together, they didn't know that because they'd been buried by the Germans, I think, hadn't they?
Yes,
Yeah.
that's correct. They were buried by the Germans and
So
then
they would, as far as
reinterred.
they're concerned, they were missing, and it was
Yes.
a year or so before it was accepted that they had died. And
Yeah.
all those letters and correspondence was in that file.
It's a heart-wrenching story when you read, even in those days, just the correspondence and the newspaper ads and the family looking for a son. Yeah, and then it happened again in 1918.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right at the end of the war. And how long after that did the parents survive? Did they live for after the loss to both sons?
William Toke Dooner passed away in 1926, I think
Right.
it is.
Right.
The eldest son passed away in 1927, and they lost a daughter, I
Oh.
think, to like tuberculosis or consumption.
Yeah.
Her name was Charlotte, And they lost her at the age of 13 and a half. He writes in his diary about that, William does, about
I
losing
would
his
never,
daughter. So.
I can't imagine losing one. Well, I just can't imagine any of it, but just imagine
Yeah.
trying to deal with the loss of four of your children, two in battle and two of
Yeah.
natural causes before your time's up. It's not meant to be like that, is it?
I have on my wall upstairs, I've got them all with all the photos that I've come back. I've digitalized them all and I have them all on the wall.
Yeah.
And I stand there and I look at them and I just think, what happened?
Yeah.
In your lives,
Yeah.
that just became so sad. You lost, certainly for William and his wife, that they lost Alfred
Yeah.
at 22 in
22. Yeah.
1914, that
Yeah.
they lost John at 39 in 1918,
Yeah.
that they lost William at in 1927, a year after the father passes. So that leaves a mother and daughter because they've already lost a daughter way back in 13 and a half. So that just left the daughter Mildred was the only one, and she had married Brigadier General Sir Archibald Murray.
Yeah.
So she became Lady Murray.
Yeah.
And she is an author of a couple of books on the officers who fell. I think the major one she did was through the Boer War.
Right.
She's compiled a whole list of
Yeah.
British and Commonwealth officers that were lost at
Right.
that time. So that just left her and the mother Matilda were the sole survivors of that family because of what happened
Yeah.
during the First World War.
Like you said, it's been like the same experience I had in
Yes.
2001. It's been a life changing moment for you at Hooge Crater, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will have encountered the same feeling.
Yes.
And it
Yeah.
could be that listening to your story as well, it's gonna make people want to find out more about, a soldier in their family they perhaps don't even know about at the moment.
Yeah.
We might be setting the standard for people to come. It might, stimulate them to go and find out more and go
Yes.
through the same experience. What would you say to people? Would you say it's worth something worth doing?
It's a life-changing experience
Yeah.
to find people that you didn't know that you had in your family, that you don't know or didn't know your family history
Yeah.
and how far back it goes back hundreds of years. How
Yeah.
far this goes, how in depth this is, the people, the lives that they all had,
Yeah.
that I knew nothing of. And certainly, through your podcasts and the way you've been able to encourage me to just keep thinking, to keep looking, to keep investigating these kinds of things, that would be my advice. Never stop looking, never turn up, keep turning those stones over. One of the things that certainly was important to me was to turn up on the doorstep where it was in the UK. Yeah, sure, made contact, made appointments, and those kinds of things. But there's nothing like being there or going there.
Yeah.
There's nothing like standing in front of those headstones,
Yeah.
whether you're related or not.
Yeah, that's right. And being on the battlefield itself, because it, obviously
Yes.
Zandvoort, where it all happened, is a couple of miles away from Hooge Crater. And did you manage to go to, well, you did, because you took a photograph of the memorial, didn't you, of the, oh, it is an incredible story, it really is. And this is
With
why, you learn all the time. I didn't know anything about this battle, really, this particular part of the battle, and it's only one small part of the First Battle of Ypres, with the 50,000 casualties over that period. It's just a small section of it, and that's why I think that's why it's so interesting,
Right at the start of the war.
because we're drilling right down into the hand-to-hand experience of the not just the British but the German soldiers as well. And we see you'll see when you hear the German account from that guy, they're living in hell. Absolute
Yes.
hell. The bodies are lying all around them. There's the filth and everything else. No proper latrines. The battle, they'd only just got there. It's not like they'd been there for weeks or months or years. They'd only just got there.
And then to die within those first few weeks as well.
They were there.
I'll always come back to that point in Ypres of finding that grave. I'll always come back to the 30th of October 1914. I always come back to looking at that photo of Alfred, the photo of the group of officers, And it really stirs my heart to think, what
Of
happened to you
course.
guys?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, you're just 22 years of age.
Yeah. And what would become of them had World War One not occurred? Had they not been there? Had they been able to
Yeah.
live the life that we've had? That's what I always think about. Your relative was 22, mine was 20. We've lived three times the life that they had. What
Yes.
could they have achieved? Especially when you look at what they'd already achieved by that age, when you look at their biographies, they were very talented people, weren't they?
So what was your emotion when this started for you and you go and stand in front of a grave with the Wenham family name on it?
Well, my dad was still alive at the time, and a year later he came out with me to see it. So I think that was the best thing for me, was to be able to share that moment, not at the time, but obviously I rang dad and told him, but to share it with dad, because it was him that had set me on this journey in the first place. I was fortunate for me that it happened when my dad was alive, and my uncle Dennis as well. But I tell you what, it made me, same as you, I wanted to find out more about him. And I didn't have a photograph of him at the time, but I found it in the newspaper archives down
Oh, fabulous.
in London. So I could see what he looked like, and it just made me determined to find out more about Henry. But then, of course, it then you know his story. I'm looking at him now. He's taking me on to helping all these other people find out their
Yes.
stories as well, and it's taken me on to the podcast, and it's taken me on to being a volunteer for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and very important to me, being part of the soldiers' charity and raising money for the soldiers of today. His
Yes.
death, to me now, his death or his life actually means something, because I was able to pick up his story after 85 years after he died. I was able to pick up his story and turn his story into something meaningful.
My story stirs me deeply, and I may be a little biased, because it involves my family, but it's just things that I never knew anything about. And it's not just finding one name, it's just giving me years and years of stories of people, of names, of places, of what ranks they were, what they did. It's just, I can't believe that standing in front of one grave
And change
gave
your
me
life
all
like
of this, and as what you have experienced as well with the
that. Yeah,
one grave
definitely.
and
Yeah,
going on to
you
the
know, there'll be
podcast series.
lots of people listening to this have either had the same emotion, or having listened to this, they will be having that same emotion in the future, and
Yeah.
hopefully we'll be talking to other people about their stories as well. And also the other thing we haven't touched on is when I go somewhere nice, for a nice meal, or I go to Norfolk. We've got a holiday home in Norfolk, or I go on a cruise, or we go to Madeira. I don't matter where we go, and I sit there and I think, this is nice. I always think back to him and their sacrifice, and the fact that I'm enjoying this, and how fortunate I am to be able to enjoy this. It changed me as a person. It made me appreciate my life more so than before I knew about it.
Yes, I certainly stare at photographs and documents, but certainly photographs. Now, I was 60 years of age when I walked up to that first gravesite. You know, that's getting on to at a point to find your family is.
Well, it's better than being 80. So right, okay, let's hold that thought there then. Thanks very much, Nick, for doing this.
Can I just add, Terry, that I just wanted to thank you for all your podcasts and the work you do. You've accompanied me around the world,
Oh, it's amazing.
long haul flights, motels, hotels, B&Bs. The education and the enlightenment you provide is outstanding.
Oh, thank you.
I now have a fascination with all things World War One that wasn't there previously. I look at photos, videos, films, uniforms with a complete captivation now, trying to understand what it was like for my ancestors. So, thank you for your encouragement to keep me investigating.
I'm really grateful for those very kind words. Thank you very much. It makes me feel very emotional and grateful to you and everybody else that listens. Because I'll tell you what it means. It means I'm not talking to myself.
Confirmation, you're not.
Thank you very much. Now, that's not quite the end of the podcast, because on the 100th anniversary of this battle at Zandvoort, Welsh soldiers once again returned to the battlefield, where they attended a memorial service, and the grandson of Lieutenant Colonel Cadogan unveiled a new memorial to that lost battalion of Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And the BBC local news reported on the ceremony itself.
100 years on, memorial services here in Belgium still draw a large crowd. In October 1914, an entire Welsh battalion was destroyed just outside this village of Zandvoort. Over the weekend, 200 visitors from Wales have returned to honour their sacrifice. One of them is Colonel Henry Cadogan, whose grandfather Hal was the commanding officer and who faced terrible odds.
There was no wire, they had no proper entrenching tools. Basically, they were not expecting to fight this sort of war. In 11 days, they were reduced from what amounted to 35 officers and 1,450 men down to the quartermaster and 85 men who reported for duty on the 31st of October.
What would become known as the first Battle of Ypres in this countryside was still at the beginning of World War I. There were no trenches, no defined Western Front just yet. Both sides were trying to outflank each other in a bid to secure the Channel ports to the north. And just a few miles from here in the village of Gellievelt, two other Welsh regiments were struggling to hold the Allied line. And to those South Wales borderers, you find another memorial, another service of remembrance. So many battles were to be fought over this land in the next 4 years. But those early ones defined what was to come.
I mean, I think it is remarkable looking back 100 years as a modern soldier today, the fortitude with which British, and in particular Welsh soldiers of these battles fought. They held their ground, they didn't withdraw, and it was through their bravery and their honesty that we're here today.
And in the quiet grounds of world-famous museums, here at Passchendaele, a coach full of Welsh veterans ensure these Welsh stories will not be forgotten.
Today we're going to present this book to the museum. Well, I have names here of 122 of men from the Blackwood area, but the casualties were far higher than that.
Many of those who died in October 1914 have no known grave, but their names are etched here. This gateway, which led to the front line, is now the most iconic memorial of all. Since 1927, each night the last post has played out from the Menin Gate here in Ypres. Each year, crowds are larger. Their memory does not fade. Here in Belgium, it grows.
It's nearly 12 years since that ceremony to unveil the memorial in the village of Zandvoort. And we heard a clip there, a little bit of the sounding of the last post, which we normally play at the end of the podcast. But I think we've talked this week about those men from Wales. So what I've decided to do is to play that patriotic Welsh song in memory of the 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers that were either killed, wounded or taken prisoner on the 30th of October 1914, as we play The Men of Harlech.
Men of Harlech, stop your dreaming. Can't you see their spear points gleaming? See the warrior pen of swinging to his battlefield. Men of Harlech, stand ye steady, it cannot be ever setting. All the battle were not ready, Welsh men never yield. From the hills rebounding, men's war cry sounding, some of Give these birds.